Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up later this hour, we will have a call-in for anyone who has moved to the Bronx in the last 5 years. Did you hear about those new census figures that show that last year, 2012, more people moved into the Bronx than moved out of it for the first time in decades? It was only a net of plus 115 people, so it could just be a rounding error. But still, there's a trend, and that is that more people are moving into the Bronx than they did in the past. The population of the city in general is having net in-migration, not net out-migration, which is kind of a historic change that's been taking place over time. But the much-derided Bronx in particular has now also experienced the net inflow. So coming up later in the hour, we'll have a call-in for anyone who has moved to the Bronx in the last 5 years to tell us where in the Bronx you moved to and why. And you can start posting on our comments page for that too right now. Just show your Bronx pride and post at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. If you've moved to the Bronx in the last 5 years, where in the Bronx did you move and why? Post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we'll take calls along those lines later in the hour. Now, no matter what else changes in the world, the Arab-Israeli conflict seems to remain intractable. But now, as President Obama prepares to visit Arab and Israeli leaders in the Middle East this week, we'll begin a series of conversations about the polarized peace process and whether re-elected Obama can help bring change. We begin with Palestinian-American author and Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi. He has a new book called Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. And maybe you saw his related op-ed piece in the New York Times last week. Professor Khalidi, thank you for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
You argue that U.S. policies have strengthened the Israeli right wing, even while the U.S. poses as an honest broker. Do you see this under President Obama as well as under the Bush administration?
Unfortunately, I think that this has been the case going right back to President Carter. You've had a pattern of American presidents, with the exception of George W. Bush, who I think have seen that something had to be changed and who tried, every one of them except George W. Bush, and who, after running into obstacles, essentially gave in and allowed the situation to develop in such a way that I think that the possibility of a two-state solution, which was still there in the early 90s, is pretty much gone. And I think that this president is going to perhaps go down in history as the one on whose watch the final nail was driven into that coffin.
What we usually hear about from President Obama's first term was that he tried to push Israel on settlements and got this furious backlash in Israel and from some Jewish Americans that left him seen as tilting toward the Palestinians before he pulled back on the issue entirely. If you see him as enabling the Israeli right and they see him as biased against them, can both things be true?
Yes. In fact, Israeli leaders have gotten used to pushing back furiously at American presidents on the Palestine issue and getting their way since Prime Minister Begin. And that is what has happened. They don't like being pushed. They didn't like President Bush Sr. pushing them. They didn't like President Clinton pushing them. And they didn't like President Obama pushing them. And I think, as I suggest in the book, there are a number of other reasons for their particular dislike of President Obama. But in fact, this is part of a pattern. And the important thing is the outcomes, Brian. We are talking about a situation in which the number of settlers has nearly tripled since the Oslo process began in 1991 at the Madrid Peace Conference. We're talking about a situation in which the Palestinians are confined into ghettos in the West Bank and in Gaza in ways that simply weren't the case 30 years ago, 25 years ago. We're talking about a situation where Israeli control over the occupied territories is actually much stronger than it was before. I mean, it's an apartheid situation, if not worse. And this has happened, a lot of it really has happened in the last 20 years when there was supposedly a peace process ongoing.
And I'll just acknowledge without letting the segment get dragged down by the word apartheid, which so inflames people when it's spoken because it seems to recall South Africa and, you know, the moral horror that that was. And yet it comes up more and more. So if you want to take just a few minutes to just a minute, because, again, I don't want the segment to get bogged in that, down in that, but people are going to react to that. So why do you use that word? Is it to be provocative? Is it because you really think it's like South Africa? What's the point of throwing that label on it?
I mean, authorities like Bishop Tutu, who should know a thing or two about apartheid, authorities like two Israeli prime ministers, Ehud Olmert and Barak, have both used the term. All three of them use the term, as have almost any, as has almost anyone who's acquainted with South Africa in any detail. When you have two legal systems for people, when you have movement restrictions on one people, when you have segregation-like, Jim Crow-like restrictions on one people, you can call it whatever you want. If people are offended by apartheid, they can call it Jim Crow segregation. They can call it whatever they please. But you have to really avoid looking at reality to avoid seeing that you have a system which is grossly unequal. And that's been erected in large part over the last 20, 30 years when there was supposedly a peace process ongoing. So the burden of this book is really to talk about the American role in this. We bankroll this. We run diplomatic interference for this system, all the while claiming that we are honest brokers in a peace process, which in fact we, the United States, which in fact I don't think we have been.
And you said a minute ago, all the way back to President Carter, which might surprise some listeners because, among other things, he wrote a book about the situation with apartheid in the title, which inflamed a lot of Israelis and supporters of Israel. But when you look back in the book at the Egypt-Israeli peace deal brokered by Carter at Camp David way back in 1979, that's often taken as the gold standard of what a peace would look like with Israel and the Palestinians. And yet you write in the book that notably in historical terms, that deal kind of overlooked the Palestinians and marginalized the Palestinians. Is that your main point on that?
Well, the main point on that is that the 1978 Camp David Agreement and the 1979 peace treaty between Egypt and Israel was a great deal for Egypt and a great deal for Israel. It was a better deal for Israel in some ways than Egypt. But it was also an enormously important strategic victory for the United States because it brought Egypt into the American column away from the Soviets. It basically ensured victory for the United States in the Cold War in the Middle East. So Presidents Ford and Nixon before President Carter, were intent on moving in this direction. They sacrificed the Palestinians along the way, A, because the other objective was much more important, and B, because Prime Minister Begin really dug in his heels on this. I go into a great length at how hard Begin fought. In fact, there are new revelations out of the Israel State Archives that I've just heard about that are online, which show how fiercely Begin and successive Israeli governments fought on this issue. And American presidents who were perfectly willing to go toe-to-toe with Israel on issues that are of great strategic importance, like winning Egypt away from the Soviets, simply ended up backing down, which is what President Carter unfortunately ended up doing, as did President Bush after him, President Bush Sr. after him.
Rashid Khalidi, Columbia University professor, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East, the first of several conversations we'll have from different points of view on the Israeli-Palestinian situation as President Obama heads to that region on Wednesday. What do you make of the recent Israeli elections, which saw the rise of a more centrist party that may be more amenable than Netanyahu or the religious parties to land for peace?
Well, it depends on how you define the term centrist. I mean, Yair Lapid's party launched its electoral campaign at one of the biggest settlements in the occupied territories, at Ariel. And I see no indication that he diverges from the right-wing consensus that Israel has to keep whatever of the occupied territories it chooses to keep and that the Palestinians can get the scraps. I don't think that the situation is propitious for a deal right now, whether on the Israeli side, given the extreme right-wing parties that are in this government, Naftali Bennett's party, the Prime Minister's party, not to speak of Lapid's, but also because of the disarray on the Palestinian side. Palestinian politics are in a mess. There's a terrible divisive split which serves no one but, in my view, the occupation. And so I don't think conditions are propitious at all for any kind of serious movement, mainly because Israel is not willing to deal with the main issues. Are the Israelis ready to end the occupation now or soon? No. Are Israelis ready to give up their control over almost all important aspects of Palestinian life? No. Movement restrictions? No. And most importantly, settlements. No. So given the disarray on the Palestinian side, given the total situation of instability in the Arab world, and given the fact that I don't see our government in Washington ready to take this on seriously, I'm afraid there's not a lot that can be done between Palestinians and Israelis. That doesn't mean that our government can't do anything. We can announce our position. We can say that, you know, the United States can say it is a completely opposed to occupation and settlement, and we're not going to finance it. Israel will do as it pleases, of course. But I think that it's really important that there be, on these moral issues, on these issues of international law, on these issues that harm the image of the United States and the rest of the world, not just the Arab world, not just the Muslim world, it's very important that there, in fact, be daylight between the United States and Israel, and that we not be prisoners, as I would argue we are, in effect, of the settler lobby, of people who want permanent Israeli control over most of these territories.
So what about on the Palestinian side? Because Israelis would argue that the Palestinians are not ready to make peace, that not only did they get an offer that was good, that they should have taken when Arafat was in charge at the end of the Clinton administration, but that there was another deal with even more West Bank territory, including land swaps, in 2008 that the Palestinian leadership under Abbas rejected. And so Israelis throw up their hands and say, well, the Palestinians aren't ready to make peace on the terms that would be acceptable.
This is the standard Israeli argument, in fact, Brian, you're right. There's a little bit to it, but I think you have to go a little bit deeper than that. You have to look at the framework for the Oslo Accords, which are the basis from which everything has proceeded since the early 90s, and understand that ultimate control under this plan and under every proposal that's been offered by the Israelis or by the United States ever since rests in Israeli hands. Control over borders, control over entry and exit, control over water, control over subterranean resources, including water, control over the airspace. Even in these so-called generous offers that Barak offered at Camp David in 2000, the summit that President Clinton organized. And what Ehud Olmert put forward in 2008, all of them were predicated on a number of things that really go back to the Oslo Accords, that go back, in fact, to Begin's autonomy plan. And I'm a historian, so I really believe in the importance of some of these enduring structures that were laid down, in this case, 35 years ago. And people who look at the superficial aspects of these offers, of course, are immediately swept away. That said, I think the Palestinians have made a number of enormous mistakes. I talk about some of them in my book. I think that accepting the Oslo Accords was a terrible, terrible mistake. I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation that was negotiating in Washington from 1991 to 1993. And we understood the rigid, low ceiling that had been imposed by Secretary Baker and President Bush at the behest of the Shamir government. And within that, we tried to negotiate a way out of things such that the Palestinians could lay down the foundations for an independent state. We failed. And the negotiations went off to Oslo, and there the PLO, to my regret, and I think the regret of almost all Palestinians today, ended up accepting a deal whereby it was impossible to achieve statehood and sovereignty. That was the vision that Rabin, Prime Minister Rabin, and his advisors had. I talk about it at length in the book. And in fact, one of those advisors was on Israeli radio 2 months ago, repeating pretty much what I say in the book. We saw for the PLO that we were going to bring into the occupied territories in 1993 that they would serve a role like the South Lebanese Army. They would provide security for us at our behest. That's what the Palestinian Authority was designed to do, and that's all it has been really able to do, unfortunately.
And that is one thing that Israel continues to insist is a fundamental building block of peace. Is it not reasonable to insist that if there is going to be a state and there is going to be some radicalism among some factions of the population that want to insist on continuing to try to attack Israel, that security would not be the responsibility of that new Palestinian state and that Palestinians have to demonstrate that they're willing and able to do that before Israel has the trust to a two-state agreement?
I think that this security mantra has to really be examined very carefully. Who really needs security here? The Israelis, of course, need security. They've suffered a great deal. But let's look at casualty figures. Let's look at the weapons used. Let's look at the thousands of casualties on one side and the hundreds of casualties on the other side. Who really needs security here? When American diplomats talk about security, all they're talking about is Israel. Well, what about security for the people who are actually the victims under occupation, expelled from their homeland? I mean, I really understand an Israeli need for security. The Israelis have every right to ask for it. But I don't think that this is a one-way street and has been treated as such. There is no security for Palestinians in the agreements that are signed. Most Israeli security managers, most heads of Shabak, the ones who are on that wonderful film, The Gatekeepers, which you had the director on your show, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very good interview. Heads of the military have said that the Palestinian Authority security services have saved enormous numbers of Israeli lives. Nobody ever talks about that. Well, what about Palestinian lives being saved? What have the Palestinians gotten out of this? Go to some of these villages in the West Bank and you'll see what they've gotten. They've gotten people killed with tear gas canisters. That wonderful piece in the New York Times Sunday magazine this past weekend will give you a gritty view of it, as will the film Five Broken Cameras. So I think that the Israelis are perfectly entitled to ask for security. But I think in all of these things, there has to be reciprocity and there has to be an assumption that both peoples are human beings and equal in every respect. They have to have equal rights. They have to have an equal right to security, among other things.
I wonder how much you see religious conservatism as an issue complicating things for both sides. There is the rise of the Orthodox in Israel and their relationship to the settlements. And how much do you see Islamicism as an issue in the coming Palestinian elections? For example, it came up on the show recently that Hamas banned women from running in a marathon as an act of
right.
Sharia law. How much is that a fault line as you see it in Palestinian politics now? And does it parallel what's going on in Israeli politics?
Well, I think it parallels what's going on in the Arab world as a whole, because secular alternatives are seen to have failed in much of the Arab world and other parts of the Muslim world, for that matter. So I think that's a closer parallel. You are right, though, I think, that the rise of right-wing religious nationalism in Israel has added a new element to the mix, and it's a dangerous element, especially because a very large proportion of the settlers are people of this persuasion who have an unshakable conviction in the religious righteousness of what they're doing and are all the more extreme for it. On the Palestinian side, I think this rises in ebbs with the successes and failure of the secular alternatives. Fatah was extraordinarily popular in the occupied territories in the early 90s when it looked as if the negotiations would lead to a state. The utter failure of this approach to produce results is one of the major reasons that Hamas became the power that it has become in the 90s and in the 2000s.
So last thing, another guest in this series is going to be Jeremy Ben-Ami from the sort of liberal Israeli lobby J Street.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote the other day, looking at Obama's trip, that it is not the time for him to introduce some kind of grand bargain in some kind of public way. But he does say about the trip, quote, "It provides the president with the opportunity to provide a preemptive kiss to the Israeli people so that down the road, as the going gets perhaps tougher and there are points of disagreement or there are points where there is strong effort to move the conflict toward resolution, that the Israeli people and the state of Israel understand that the president does, in fact, have the very, very best interest of the people and the state of Israel at heart." What's your reaction to that as a potential strategy for President Obama on this trip to lay the groundwork for something more challenging in the future?
I think the president – I don't know about preemptive kisses. I'll leave that to Jeremy Ben-Ami to talk about. I think the president has a responsibility to lay down a couple of markers, to say that the United States completely disassociates itself from policies that the Israeli government is undertaking and has undertaken for decades, and that we won't bankroll them. And that we really do need see a settlement as vital. And the United States has a preference for a two-state solution. If it has that preference, it really had better get its act together and do something about that. That solution is going down the tubes or has gone down the tubes. And I think the president has, you know, history in his mind. All second-term presidents do. Does he want to be the one on whose watch a one-state solution became the only solution possible? I think we're almost there if we're not there. But I think these are the kinds of things the president should be thinking about and talking to Israelis about, because you have to move the Israeli body politic. You have to talk, in a sense, over the heads of the politicians to the people, the way the president is trying to do domestically. And I think that might be something he should be thinking about on his trip. Making Israelis feel better is all well and good. But I think saying things that first clarify the position of the United States on these issues, and secondly, make Israelis understand how much how limited support in the United States ultimately is going to be for some of these self-destructive policies that Israel has followed for many, many years.
Rashid Khalidi's new book is called Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. If you want to meet Professor Khalidi on Monday, April 1st, he'll be doing a book event at 7:30 at the Columbia University Middle East Institute on West 122nd Street. And on Tuesday, April 2nd, at 6 p.m. at the International Peace Institute, their Middle East program at 777 UN Plaza. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The series continues on Wednesday with Zev Chaifetz, the author who has a new book on an unrelated topic, but who also used to be an official in one of the Likud governments in Israel. So we continue our series of conversations on the day that President Obama leaves for the region on Wednesday with Zev Chaifetz. Coming up next, are you ready for the cat with the neon green nose? We'll talk to science journalist Emily Anthes, author of Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. Stay with us.